right. Our third speaker for today is Jonathan Yoder at CDC. And welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you. So I'll be talking about a multi-center, multi-state study that we've done. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak to you. I'm sure you're all happy to be here at 5 o'clock on a Tuesday, so we'll make this as lively as possible. Two things I wanted to say from this title slide. One, it represents a lot of work, partnership between CDC, APHL, and state laboratories. And the affiliations will be at the end, so we'll certainly recognize the folks who worked on this. And the other thing I just want to say up front is this is in response to a position statement at CSTE 5 years ago. So I just be aware that decisions have consequences, good and otherwise. So I think that's a really good, hopefully take away from this that opportunity that the types of decisions made drive research, drive improvement going forward. So just a little bit about Cryptosporidium for those who are not aware. Cryptosporidium is a parasite, and this shows the different phases of the parasite. There's the oocyst, the hard shell parasite at the top left, all the way down to the trophozoite there at the bottom right. And the significance of that is that Cryptosporidium presents some challenges because it's extremely halogen tolerant. It can resist chlorination, and its small size helps it evade filtration, which is typical in water treatment. So these oocysts that live in the environment are very environmentally stable, and it has a low infectious dose. Only a few oocysts are needed to cause infection. And different from another parasite, Cyclospora, this Cryptosporidium is immediately infectious, so it can cause illness if ingested right after it's excreted. And it's only, and there's high amounts of oocysts excreted by ill persons over long periods of time, and it also has zoonotic potential. So animals can contaminate surface water and drinking water sources. The risk factors for infection include people who use recreational water, particularly treated recreational water, people who travel to other countries, people who have contact with cattle, particularly those pre-weaned calves. And people who drink unfiltered water, untreated water, such as you'd find in the backcountry. And a little bit about the epidemiology. There's an estimated 750,000 cases in the U.S. every year. And they typically cause profuse watery diarrhea lasting for several weeks. And most of these are not serious. They don't cause hospitalization or lead to death, but there certainly are deaths in hospital. There's certainly a lot of hospitalizations and deaths every year, although it's not the majority. Higher risk of severe illness is higher in those among immune-compromised and those with HIV, severe HIV, AIDS, or undergoing cancer treatment. And I think the thing that has been something that we've watched in surveillance is the rapid increase over the last 5 to 7 years, where there's been around a 300% increase in the number of cases. Here are the data showing the reported cases to CDC. This is the incidence of cryptosporidiosis. It became a reportable disease in 1995, and it was a relatively stable reporting nationally until around 2005, when it more than doubled. And these increases post 2005, a lot of them were driven by large outbreaks, regional outbreaks. But of concern, and what we'll talk about for the rest of this time, is this case definition change 5 years ago that started, and subsequent to that, there was this increase in the reported number of non-confirmed cases, of probable cases. And we'll get back to that in just a little bit, and we'll revisit what's driving those numbers. If you look at the age groups that are affected, certainly predominantly among the young, the purple bar at the top is among those 0 to 14 years of age. And as you see these big spikes that occurred in relation to increases in the overall numbers, those are related to outbreaks. These outbreaks that occur in Swimming pools and water parks are primarily impact young children. The other age groups have also been increasing, but of considerable interest, and what we'll come back to later in the presentation, is this white line at the bottom, which is the 65-year and older group that started out from pretty much very few cases in 95 to now being the second highest incidence group. And that's of concern. We'll talk about what might be going on there in a little bit. So just an overview of laboratory methods. There are several methods, and I'll talk about the main ones here. There's a number of staining methods. The gold standard is something called the direct fluorescent antibody, DFA. There's also these rapid immunochromatographic cartridge assays, which are a type of EIA, enzyme immune assay. But we'll go into the enzyme immune assays in just a little bit. And then PCR, which is more frequently becoming used, and particularly in labs and at CDC, it's the only way we can look at genotype or subtype of Cryptosporidium. Because Cryptosporidium is shed intermittently, it's not always consistently every day. If you take stools over three consecutive days, you can really improve the sensitivity of testing. And tests for Cryptosporidium are not routinely included in ova and parasite testing. So they may not do the specific staining or specific tests that will identify Cryptosporidium if a physician orders an ova and parasite test. So here's just a little bit for non-lab folks like myself, some pictures to help illustrate what we're talking about. Here's the DFA, direct fluorescent antibody test, where they put these particular fluorescent compounds onto the slide, and it identifies these generally come both for Cryptosporidium and Giardia. So a lot of times if their physician's ordering one, they'll actually be de facto testing for both. And if you talk about a rapid cartridge assay, which will be the focus of this study, what we're talking about is this small cartridge test, where they, it's a lateral flow test, where they've taken these same assays and put them into this small cartridge, looks similar to a pregnancy test, tests for both Cryptosporidium, in the most part, tests for both Cryptosporidium and Giardia. They put the drop of diluted preserved stool into the little well there, and the line will appear for either Cryptosporidium or Giardia, or it'll be negative. So this is what we're talking about when we talk about a rapid cartridge assay, an immunochromatographic card test. And these two are the two main manufacturers of these are Meridian, and they make something called ImmunoCardStat, and the other one is Remmel Expect. There are certainly a few other brands around, a few other companies involved, but in the U.S. market, this is what is mostly used. A good question is what percentage of the tests for Cryptosporidium are performed by these. I don't know that I have an exact number, but it seems to be increasing year after year, and the data that I see seems to say that it may be between 70% and 90% of tests in the community for Cryptosporidium are using these tests. If you think about it, traditional parasitology is not practiced in many community hospital labs anymore. Even in some state laboratories, it's not available. And so people are going to a rapid point of care test where they can get an answer in 15 minutes, make a decision, and send the person on their way. But there have been challenges. As much as we like to get an answer quickly, as much as we like to increase testing, because this is certainly an under-recognized disease, there are problems with both the EIA, the broader category of enzyme immune assays, and the more specific rapid cartridge assays. There's problems with antigen production, and there have been multiple lots of the EIA tests that have been recalled due to problems with antigen production. And then more specifically on the rapid cartridge assays, there were over the last 15 years, there have been problems with in several times in 2002 with poor temperature control, and also in 2004 with problem with the antigen production, and again another problem in 2004 where operators were not reading them at the proper time. Basically, they would batch them together, they'd put them all together all morning, and then go to lunch and come back and read them all in the afternoon. And if you leave them there too long, you get ghost bands that appear, and it looks like a positive when it's really not a positive. And more recently, and what's driven this CSDE position statement or changing case definition nationally in 2011 was the result of a study out of Minnesota where they saw a lot of false positives where they could not confirm tests from the community lab. And so they wrote a paper describing that, and that led to the changing case definition and the subsequent desire to look at it to see if it's a more broad problem than just one specific state. So, as I mentioned, the goal of this study was to look at testing for rapid cartridges, were there false positives occurring in multiple states. We worked with APHL to put a request for proposals, and the study design was those labs that had over 100 cryptosporidium samples annually, and that included Wisconsin, New York, and Minnesota. They collected the community laboratory information, the sample characteristics, including the preservative and the time from testing to retesting, and routine demographic information that they were already collecting as part of routine surveillance. And here's a very simplified diagram of the design, study design. An ill person goes to their community laboratory, their clinic, their hospital, and is tested with a rapid test. If they're negative, there's no further information. They're not considered to continue. But if it's positive, then that sample is sent to the state laboratory, where it's retested with both a rapid cartridge, and in this study, we use both the REML test and the Meridian test, along with tested again with DFA, with the gold standard test. So we could compare both the rapid cartridge test in the community to rapid cartridge in the state lab, and also the rapid cartridge in the community with the gold standard test. Here are the results. Among these three sites, there are 392 positive samples that were forwarded onto the state lab. 79% of these were the Meridian ImmuniCard STAT test, and 20% of them were REML. There was a few other tests used, but these were the two that were the majority of the tests. And you can see the preservative used. Most of these are approved for use in these tests, FAF, or SAF, Cary-Blair, and Formalin. Certainly there are a few others that were not the manufacturer doesn't necessarily approve for these tests. Here's the challenging situation, that among those community positive samples, only 61%, almost 62% could be confirmed at the state laboratory. And that included only 55% of those tested positive with an ImmuniCard STAT, meaning you're almost it's a 50-50 shot that if you were positive in the community that you'd be positive by the gold standard test at the state lab. And the REML test performed a good bit better. And then when we repeated that rapid test at the state lab, they certainly performed better, meaning that then we could get up to the point where 86% or almost 87% of those that were RSA positive, the rapid test positive, the state lab, were then confirmed by DFA. Still not up to the level of the manufacturer's stated performance. And of course, it was still worse among the Meridians, but about 95% of the REMLs were positive when tested. And here's another way of looking at it visually, where you have on the left side is Meridian. Those are the community tests. The percentage at the top is those that were not confirmed. So you had certainly 45% when they compared DFA to the community test, they were not confirmed, and then 16% when they tested at the state lab and compared to DFA on the Meridian, and then you can see REML on the right side. But there was significant difference by age. So among those young, the test performed much better. So it was less than 20 years of age, 86% were positive when you retested, comparing the community result with DFA. But among those over 60 years old, only 12.5% could be confirmed. Which means there's something going on here where there's such a difference in result between depending on age, and that difference remains, though not as striking even when the testing was redone at the state lab. And here's a graph showing that that difference. And it's very striking to say that we almost did not receive a positive in among those over 60 years or older at the state lab. And this is specifically among Meridian, because that was the majority of these samples, so we compared it just to Meridian, and that there was a real problem as age increased with being able to confirm those results. And again, to bring you back to this slide, which is the drivers of our data by age, and this white line at the bottom is a real concern, because these are over 65s that are increasing and have now become the second highest incident rate in national surveillance. We really have concern about them, because they is that a true increase, or is there something else? Is this all driven by problems with this test? And I will say that the type of test and age were significant predictors of false positive results. So the difference between Meridian and Rummel and age. There was one, the only other difference, but accounted for a very specific small percentage of the cases, was the type of preservative. Those that were not in correct preservative were also significantly less likely to be confirmed. But if you remember, that only accounted for less than 10% of these results. So it doesn't drive the overall numbers in the way that both type of test and age do. So what can we say from this? Here we looked at the data. There's a high rate of false positives from RCAs used in clinical laboratories, and this was shown to be consistent, although slightly different across states. More frequently observed with laboratories that use this, the Meridian ImmunoCard stat. And some of this might be a problem with handling, meaning we did have a better result when they were tested strictly according to the manufacturer's guideline in the state lab and then retested, although they still never reached the level of the manufacturer's published performance and, frankly, CDC's testing of them when they were introduced over 10 years ago. So I'm not sure that accounts for all of the problem here, even though we do have to be aware that in real-world situations, tests that are so fragile that they cannot be done correctly most of the time are still a problem. Those over 65 were significantly more likely to have false positive results. And an interesting thought here from our laboratory is that there could be production of a nonspecific antibody in the elderly that mimic the cryptosporidium epitope. And that's something that we'll have to look into more fully. I think they've seen it with other parasitic infections, that this potentially could be a problem, something that's not necessarily accounted for. My guess is most of the pre-market testing for these tests and most of the testing that's been done has been done with children, because that's where most of the cases occur. And so this may be an unforeseen problem with these tests. So what are the implications for this? And what should we do next? We had hoped this would be a study that gave us a simple answer that we could fix quickly. apparently not the case. So I think we do have to keep this in mind when we look at cryptosporidium epidemiology. There's going to be continued proportion of non-confirmed cases, and that's likely to increase. The position or the new case definition says that if a test is done with one of these rapid tests, the state should report them as probable, not non-confirmed. I think the problem has been in the past is that there's not great data on what the laboratory is doing, what type of test, and so states have been stuck with not knowing how to report their cases. As they learn more about how their tests, their cases are being tested, I think that proportion will actually increase, and that's a big challenge for understanding national data. So it is important for states to know the type of test used by the community reporting laboratories. There's a poster, I believe it's a poster at this conference that says that looking at FoodNet data, only 22% of the reporting labs in FoodNet can actually say that their crypto test should be reported as confirmed. So meaning they either don't know the type of test or they know it's being used, or what's being used is a test that's not considered non-confirmed. And I think we have to do more work to figure out why are we having the decreased performance What's going on here? How can we dialogue with the manufacturer and FDA to figure out how to fix this? And I think the long-term step is probably moving away from these rapid tests and towards a PCR-based approach, where we could actually do something that will help us understand the genotype and subtype and be able to link, use molecular epidemiology to link cases together, detect outbreaks, and look and evaluate interventions to reduce disease. So as I mentioned, this was a study that was done with a lot of folks from New York, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Kentucky, and APHL, and folks at CDC, and acknowledge Poop for the big part Poop had in playing in this study. So thanks. Any questions? I'll be glad to answer them.
First time I've ever heard someone thank Poop. So you deserve extra applause for that alone. There's a question coming up. June?
So I was just wondering if you looked at your data to see, you know, I always think that spike that happened in the overall incidence in 2005 is because of these tests, to see what the, I know you're collecting data now about the adoption in the laboratories, and maybe you don't have it back in 2005. Is there any thought of seeing whether that's actually true?
I think it's a really good question. The tests have been around, you know, since the late 90s, but were they more frequently adopted in 2005? When I guess that was probably when all the other rapid tests were coming out as well.
I think it'd be interesting to look and see if the sales or something of that test, and like whether that's what caused those.
We certainly have asked for that from the companies, and they always claim it's proprietary, and they can't provide it for us, and we'd love to have a better working relationship with them. I think it's a great idea, because we've always hypothesized that was also around the time when there was a drug that was approved for treating cryptosporidium. We've still not been able to tease out whether that's a driver in this as well. Certainly there's well-documented outbreaks during that time. New York State, and big one in 2005. A large outbreak a couple of years later in Texas, and then Utah, big outbreaks. But I agree, I don't know that it's all related to those outbreaks.
And then I had a second question. Was the rapid tests that weren't confirmed at the same time, could that possibly have been, were the specimens collected at the same time, or was it like an old specimen that then couldn't be confirmed at the state lab, like a patient with a media?
I think it's a good question, but there we did look at time from collection to initial test and time from collection to retesting at the state lab, and there was certainly no significant difference between that. Could it have had any impact on it? I mean, I think I don't want to discount that, because I think I think that could be the case, but it should, you know. It seemed the data would say that they were preserved, you know, the ones that there wasn't a significant difference between those that were delayed retesting and not, but maybe there is some.
But you did show that one slide with the commercial lab at the state lab when they did the rapid test, they would have performed better.
Yes.
So maybe it's something to do with how they're handling.
It could certainly be, and I think that absolutely is an issue here. I think there's an ongoing need. We could certainly improve it to some level by having folks do a better job at the community lab. I was hoping that was all that it was. I'm concerned that that's not all that it is. So, yeah.
Hi, I'm Tracy DeSalvo from Wisconsin. And, you know, certainly I'm hoping that the PCR test will also replace some of this and improve it. But I'm wondering, we have seen, maybe for instance, the long-term care facility outbreak, where they call us and say, oh my gosh, this facility in January is having a crypto outbreak, and we get those specimens to our state lab, and it turns out those people all have norovirus, not cryptosporidium. And so I'm wondering if there's been any consideration given to taking this one step further and saying, well, let's do a multiplex PCR panel or some other testing on those ones that come up negative at the state lab to see what, especially maybe your elderly population actually has.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. I mean, I think that'd be great. It's obviously everything's about resources and interest. But I think I would love to be able to do that, whether it's the CDC or at the state lab, where they say, if you're not finding cryptosporidium, are you finding something else? We actually were, one of the things we were concerned about, and I didn't talk about much here, was that a lot of asymptomatic individuals were being tested for cryptosporidium, and that still may be the case, but again, we didn't see that as an issue here. There was no difference in symptomatic versus asymptomatic, but yeah, we were concerned about that. But I think that'd be great to actually figure out what's going on there. If they have diarrhea, what actually is causing the diarrhea?
Yeah, and it's a state with a high burden of crypto cases, we certainly, have concerns about these tests and what it's really showing us for our cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You have questions?
So on that note, I think, I guess that you want to approach the manufacturer and work to improve the test, but can you tell me if you know anything about the conversations that are maybe going on at the state or local level with the labs about why they would use such a poor test at all for confirmatory purposes?
You mean at the community
at the
lab?
Clinical level.
Yeah.
Why would they embrace this kind of test?
I think you have a situation where, and this is a little different from the bacterial side, where you have culture and the culture independent diagnostics is another issue, and there's big issues with rapid tests there, and those are being used. What's driving this is cost, whereas you it's hard for a community lab to employ a parasitologist, mm-hmm. So that they can't, or a hospital even. A lot of them don't even make that decision. The doctor writes for cryptosporidium testing or Giardia testing. They don't even do the test there. They send it off to a commercial lab, and they don't know they don't even know what test is being done at that commercial lab. They just say, "Give me I just want a result." And so, if that commercial lab in their cost analysis thinks that this is cheaper for us to just have these tests than have someone to look at a microscope and use these direct fluorescent antibodies, that's a cost decision. So I really think that, I agree that maybe the manufacturer is not the right way to go. I think we actually have to engage FDA in a real discussion on this to drive, as a post-market thing, to drive, that this is driving healthcare costs in the wrong direction, meaning you're potentially treating people for the wrong thing and not treating them for what they actually have, if anything. So I think that's, but I don't know how engaged they are, because I don't know how often they pull in post-market data to make decisions like this. I don't know that answers your question, but I think it's driven by cost. And you ask why they do it. I'm not going to name names, but there are some state laboratories, this rabbit cartridge is their test. When they are asked to confirm a cryptosporidium or Giardia test, what they have in their state laboratory is a rapid test. So it's not just, I can't blame community laboratories, it's being driven as well as state laboratories.
Just as a follow-up to that one, I presume, to frame the question, that it's not well known that the Meridian performs so much more poorly than the Remel, but is there a price difference between the Meridian and the Remel? Why do you have four times as many Meridian tests as the Remel? Is one just newly on the market? The Remel is newer,
I think that's part of it. Meridian is much more established. Kind of the original one. That's my understanding of it. I can't say that I know for sure. Maybe Meridian has a better marketing or better strategy, and there could be a price difference as well.
No.
But it could be, Remel seems to have set up their, they may be more specific and less sensitive. Somehow they've set up their algorithm a little differently, or maybe it's just a better test. So, yeah.
Other question? I'll keep asking you questions. The epidemiologist in me wants to ask the question about the incidence figures that you showed,
yes.
Stratified by age, mm-hmm. Because given what you said later about the low positive predictive value in the elderly, I wonder how much of that is artifact.
I wonder that too. No, I mean, I really do.
Well, come on, speculate.
No, because I No, I mean, I think if you think about what are the primary risk factors for cryptosporidiosis, it's recreational water, and I certainly, you know, maybe the elderly are increasingly getting in recreational water. I'm not sure, but certainly not to the level that kids under 10 do.
Mm.
Certainly probably don't have the contact with calves or that necessarily. So I really do, and that's not to say there couldn't be other sources of it, but I don't see there. It doesn't necessarily make sense that you'd have this continual increase without any identified outbreaks in the elderly. Meaning we don't find, I mean, I don't know if Wisconsin or other places find outbreaks in the elderly. We certainly have. We've had pseudo outbreaks where people say, like you said, and then assisted living facility, you find it, and then we test them and there's nothing there. So I think that's what makes us concerned about the data. And it's why it's such an issue. It's not just an issue. It's an issue for the person being treated or being told they have cryptosporidium, but it's also an issue for national surveillance data. It has implications for a lot of what we do and where we put our resources. So, I wish I had an answer for you, but yeah.
Well, we've gotten to the end of time. I think we've had some good discussion. I think we've definitely heard some wicked presentations. So please join me in thanking all of our presenters.